everybody. Cheryl Atkison here. Welcome to another edition of Full Measure After Hours. Today, the full measure interview with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. as he talks about America's chronic disease epidemic, censorship and corruption inside our government agencies, the Biden administration denying him Secret Service protection, working with Donald Trump, and Democrats rigging the election.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
If you get elected president, what do you see as the first executive actions you take?
Well, the first day I would, first of all, I will pardon Julian Assange and pardon Edward Snowden. And I will also issue, again on the first day, an executive order forbidding any federal agencies or federal government employee from participating in efforts to censor speech in our country, to coordinate with social media or the media sites to censor speech. And that, and I'll forgive, I will pass an executive order forbidding the CIA from propagandizing American people, which, you know, was always the rule in this country until 2016.
Would you pardon Donald Trump?
I don't know. I don't even know what Donald Trump is being accused of. And so I wouldn't answer that. And it would be imprudent. You're not, pardons are for people who've been convicted of crimes.
Would you consider it?
I'm not going to answer that.
A Rasmussen Reports poll just found that one in three Democrats say they might vote for you if you were to leave the Democrat Party and run as a third-party candidate. What thoughts do you have about that?
If the Democratic Party does not allow me to actually have a fair election, in other words, if they, you know, continue doing what they're doing, which is to rig the outcome of the election, then I would look at all options.
Can you explain in simple terms what the Democrat Party is doing to discourage your candidacy?
There's a list of that somebody's put out of 60 different things that the Democratic Party has done to fix the election, to make sure that that President Biden gets it, or that they control the outcome. I mean, one of the most, I think, egregious thing is that they've passed a rule that says that any candidate who steps into New Hampshire, that no vote that is cast for that candidate in New Hampshire will count toward them. And so I have campaigned in New Hampshire. I've been campaigning there from the beginning. And every delegate that I win from New Hampshire will go instead to President Biden. So that's, you know, and they have the potential to do the same thing in Iowa. And so those are, you know, those are things that that normally have never been done in this country before. The Democratic Party is supposed to be, by its own charter, it's supposed to be neutral in the election. It's supposed to act as a referee. But this is like if you showed up at a football game and the referee was wearing your opponent's uniform. It's the same thing. The 5 days after President Biden announced his candidacy, the DNC endorsed him. That's never happened before. And then the DNC and the President Biden's campaign merged. So they're operating out of the same office. They have the same fundraising team. And it's just one campaign. And, you know, it's more akin to what we saw in the Soviet Union during, you know, the Soviet era, when the political party, in that case the Communist Party, was claiming that they had a democracy. But the way they controlled the democracy is the party alone could designate who the nominees were. And so the only people the public could vote on were candidates that were chosen by the party apparatchiks rather than, you know, the public. And we've always prided ourselves in this country on having a true democracy where the candidates were chosen not by political bosses but by the people of the states.
Why do you think the Democrat Party is so against your candidacy? Lifelong Democrat, Kennedy is a Democrat Party name.
I think the Democratic Party is increasingly dependent on corporate money, and that I think there's concern that if they elect a populist candidate like Tulsi Gabbard or Bernie Sanders or myself, that the corporate faucets will be shut off, that it will offend their donors, their donor base. And so I think I believe that the Democratic Party would rather see President Trump elected than me, because if President Trump is elected, they'll continue to be able to collect money from their donor base. But if a progressive like myself were elected and challenged this hegemony, this, you know, corrupt merge of state and corporate power, which sustains both political parties. You know, it really is the uniparty, and both parties are involved with protecting those corporate donors, and they're the same corporate donors. And I think that frightens them that flow of money would be shut off.
What you describe happening with the political parties, something similar might be said about federal agencies and sort of how the establishment, whatever that may be, is controlling things in politics. How do you view the federal agency situation I described, and how would you attack or change that?
Well, we see corporate capture across all the federal agencies. And, you know, corporate capture is a well-documented phenomena that happens not just in this country, but around the world. And it happens at the state level and the federal level, where the regulatory agencies become captured by, they become sock puppets for the industry that they're supposed to regulate. And we've seen that process amplify over the federal government over the last few years, and particularly since the Citizens United case in 2006 or 2008 freed up the tsunami of corporate money into the political process. And so we've seen that, you know, this process, this corrupting process that was occurring anyway, to accelerate. And I think I'm in a very unique position to be able to unravel some of that corporate capture, because I've spent 40 years suing the corporations that are the most active in that dynamic, but also suing the agencies. I've litigated them against almost all of the federal agencies, the major agencies, against DOT, against the Department of Agriculture, USDA, against the EPA, against the public health agencies, NIH, CDC, FDA. And when you sue these agencies, you get it's like getting a PhD in how to unravel corporate capture. And many of the agencies, I know exactly the people, the personnel that need to be removed. And a lot of the public health agencies particularly, there's a series of perverse incentives that actually encourage the agency to become captured by the pharmaceutical industry. FDA gets 50% of its budget, almost 50% of its budget, from pharmaceutical companies. That would be like, you know, the EPA is a captive agency. It's captive by oil, coal, pesticide. What would EPA look like if half of its money came from the coal industry, and if it's if the flow of that money was dependent on coal making a lot of money? We'd see, you know, agency capture on steroids. Well, that's what it's like for the pharmaceutical industry and the public health agencies. So NIH, for example, under the Bayh-Dole Act, which was passed in 1984, people who work for NIH can now make money on pharmaceutical products that they regulate. So if you work on a product at NIH, for example, the mRNA vaccine, the Moderna vaccine, there are six people at NIH who worked on that product, just went through, who were close deputies of Anthony Fauci, who was the head of NIAID. And those individuals were allowed to have margin rights on the patent. So they will collect royalties, $150,000 a year forever, and their children, and their children, as long as that product's on the market. And so, you know, the mercantile ambitions of those individual regulators ultimately is destined to subsume the regulatory function of the agency. You actually have people who are paying for their cars, their houses, their boats, their children's education, as long as the product they're regulating continues to be marketed in a widespread way to the public. So instead of looking for problems, which is what do you want the regulators to do, to find all the problems in that product, their incentive is to turn a blind eye toward problems and just make sure there's maximum uptake no matter how bad the product is.
A related question on censorship. The Twitter files revealed that you were targeted by government and vaccine interests for questions you raised and information you distributed about COVID and COVID vaccines, even when it was absolutely true. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, they had to, the White House had to invent a new word when it was ordering Facebook and Twitter to censor me. And the word was, because Facebook was actually saying the things that we're being asked to censor are actually true. And for me, nobody's been able to point to a single post on Instagram or Twitter that I made that was factually inaccurate. We have a very, very robust fact-checking operation at Children's Health Defense, and you know, we had over 300 PhD scientists and MD physicians in our on our scientific advisory board. So we had a lot of eyeballs on my posts before I ever posted them, and everything that I did was cited and sourced to peer-reviewed publications or to in the medical journals or government databases. And I, of course, was very careful about that. So they couldn't find anything that I wrote that was actually misinformation, that was erroneous. Oh, they made up a new word, which is malinformation. And malinformation is information that is true, but nevertheless inconvenient for government. And they began censoring me on that. I was the first individual who was censored by the Biden administration 37 hours after President Biden took the oath of office, in which he swore to uphold the Constitution. The White House was violating the First Amendment by ordering the social media sites to censor me, and the White House was using the threat of abolishing the Section 230 immunity that is critical for the business model of those companies. Section 230 immunity is the section that says that individuals cannot sue social media companies like Google, Facebook, Twitter for defamation, for defamatory statements that are published by, that are put online by one of their customers. In other words, if you wrote something defamatory about me and published it on an op-ed or in a letter to the New York Times, I could sue you, Cheryl Atkinson, but I could also sue the New York Times for publishing it. And so the social media sites, when they were, you know, in their natal years, understood that if they had to vet the New York Times, every letter that goes up and every op-ed piece by an outside writer is vetted by their lawyers to make sure that it doesn't include defamatory statements. Of course, Facebook can't do that. Facebook and Twitter and Instagram cannot vet every single post with attorneys. They would go, I mean, Mark Zuckerberg has said it's existential for us. If we lose that Section 230 immunity, we will go bankrupt. And the White House, we now know, and this is all in Judge Doughty's 155-page decision, in which he enjoined the White House from having any conversations about censorship with any of the social media companies. But in that decision, he chronicles exactly what happened, and he chronicles that, you know, that the White House was threatening the social media sites that if you do not censor our political opponents, we will abolish your Section 230 immunity. So it was unprecedented in American history. The government has never done that. I mean, I'm sure there's times in our history when the government tried to pressure media sites to censor their opponents. But in this case, it was wholesale. It was systematic. It was widespread. And, you know, there were literally thousands of people who ended up being censored. Mothers who reported that their child had been injured by a medical product were abolished. Doctors who saw patients who were injured or who had treatment regimens that, you know, that they felt worked to restore people, they were removed from the social media. And then any discussion of scientific articles, even publications of CDC's own website that showed things that were critical of vaccine safety, those posts were removed. And you know, it wasn't good for public health, and it wasn't good for our democracy.
What do you do about that? I mean, we only know about some of it because states have litigated, but certainly Congress didn't do anything to stop it. The media wasn't a good watchdog policing this sort of thing. And the Biden administration will say they did nothing wrong. So how do you prevent something like that from happening?
Well, as president, I would prevent it by issuing an executive order immediately. You can't prevent it forever because the next president can come in and, you know, put in his own executive order. But I would try to pass legislation as well so that just to make it, and particularly the intelligence agencies, we need to get a handle on them because, as we now know, the FBI had opened a portal so that they could directly censor Facebook and Twitter. And they were allowing the CIA also to censor people that they didn't want, censor discussions that they did not want to occur in public.
You have written about, litigated on, and researched vaccine side effects and vaccine injuries more than any other political candidate. I think that's safe to say. And yet I frequently hear you questioned by media reporters who are misinformed and claim that the true information that's documented is false, that you're putting out misinformation, and then they throw at you information that is actually false. It's sort of an Alice in Wonderland situation. How does a candidate like you that is clearly opposed by the establishment and your own party and many in the media, how do you pierce that and actually make a viable run?
Well, you know, there are now, luckily, other vectors through which I can reach the public other than mainstream media. If I was just dealing with the mainstream media, my candidacy would not have a prayer. But now we have this whole ecosystem of podcasting that, you know, is it's actually bigger than the mainstream media. I mean, CNN is getting 500,000 viewers a night, and at the same time that Joe Rogan gets 11 million viewers per podcast. So you can reach comparable number of people in the alternative media now, and that's been an effective weapon in my arsenal.
You've spoken more than any candidate that I've heard about a really big problem: chronic health disorders that are plaguing our society, our children, and adults as well, such as immune disorders like juvenile diabetes, Crohn's, POTS, celiac disease, as well as disorders like autism, the epidemic that has not been successfully addressed even by the most well-funded public health agencies in the world. What would you do about that, and what are your ideas about the chronic health problems we suffer?
Well, we've gone to, from having 6% of Americans have chronic disease when my uncle was president, to probably around 60% now. We don't really know because NIH won't publish the numbers or do the studies. But by 1986, it was 11.8%. By 2006, 54% of American kids had chronic disease. And I did see a recent study that showed that one out of every seven kids has autoimmune diseases. So the levels are sickening, and we have the sickest generation of kids that we've ever had in our country, and we are the sickest country in the world. And it's reflected in the cost that we pay for medicine in this country, for medical care. Medical care devours $4.3 trillion a year, and about 80% of that goes to chronic disease. So, you know, if we're going to survive economically, James Lyons-Weiler, who's a professor and scientist who published a report recently that showed that the cost of treating autistic Americans with autism, will exceed $1 trillion a year by 2030. So, you know, it's going to bankrupt us. But also, you know, these are kids who won't be serving in the military, and, you know, who won't pay taxes, and they're being taken, being removed as productive contributing citizens to the larger society in ways that I think can't help but just damage everything about our country. And then the other diseases, as you mentioned, the allergic diseases, food allergies, peanut allergies, which suddenly exploded in 1989, eczema, asthma, which, you know, my brother had asthma when we were kids, and he was told by his doctor there would never be a cure because it was so rare that nobody would ever study it. Today, one out of every eight black children in America City has asthma. And then the neurological disease, ADD, ADHD, speech delay, language delay, tics, Tourette's syndrome, narcolepsy, ASD, autism suddenly exploded. And of course, the autoimmune diseases that you mentioned, and obesity. So we spend more per capita, two or three times what European countries do. And yet we have the worst health outcomes. We have the worst health system in the world.
How do you change that?
Well, we change it by lifting the ban on studying chronic disease. Clearly the chronic disease is caused by environmental toxins, environmental exposures. But the environmental exposures, the potential, you know, are glyphosate from pesticides, from Roundup, neonicotinoid pesticides. We know this because they had to follow the timeline where the big epidemics began around 1989. Oh, you have to figure out an exposure that hit all Americans, every demographic beginning around 1989. There's a limited number of them. High fructose corn syrup, cell phone radiation, and, you know, there are PFOAs, which are flame retardants that were put in a lot of products, our children's pajamas, and almost every piece of furniture at that time. And then the vaccine schedule that, of course, went from three vaccines I had as a kid to 72 vaccines over a very short period of time during that period. And all of those diseases, by the way, are listed on the manufacturer's inserts for those 72 vaccines as potential side effects. So those have to be a culprit, too. It's probably a combination of all of these, insults. American children are now swimming around in a toxic soup. And probably every exposure amplifies the, you know, they all tend to work on the same, along the same biological pathways, and they tend to be cumulative, so that they they're operating with each other to cause all this damage. And you know, at some point, the children just get pushed off a ledge into the abyss of chronic disease. What I will do as president is I'll immediately lift the ban on, there's certain databases where you could get most of this information from overnight, including the Vaccine Safety Data Link, and I will lift the ban on, though the CDC does not allow any independent scientists to look at that database, and I'll lift those bans right away. I will call the medical journals into the Attorney General's office, and I will and we'll tell them that we're going to prosecute you for, as the journals are now, you know, lying to the public, and you lying constantly, and even the heads of the journals, Marcia Engel from the longtime editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, and Richard Horton, the longtime editor of the Lancet, are saying there's nothing in these journals that you can trust anymore. They've become vessels for you know, mercantile propaganda from the pharmaceutical industry. And so I'm going to call them in and tell them that we're going to file racketeering suits against them because they're lying to the public. They're committing frauds, and they're the object of huge injuries to the public because doctors are relying on what they saw in those journals, and when the editors themselves know that they're not true. I'm going to go down to Bethesda, to NIH headquarters, and I'm going to say to them, we're going to shift a lot of our focus now from development of incubating pharmaceutical drugs, pharmaceutical products, which is what NIH does, a lot of them to treat the chronic disease that they're causing. And I'm going to say, we're going to start figuring out what's causing the chronic disease. And there's a lot of other things that need to be done. We need to get pharmaceutical advertising off of TV so that the television stations can return to telling the truth to the American public about health, rather than serving as propagandists for this very, very corrupt industry. This is the same industry, I'll remind you, that brought us the opioid crisis, which, you know, we last year we lost 106,000 American children. That's twice what we lost in Vietnam during 20 years, and all that gone last year. And, you know, originally this addiction epidemic began with the OxyContin. Anybody who wants to, you know, see how corrupt the pharmaceutical agencies, you know, in tandem, the pharmaceutical industry in tandem with the regulatory agencies, look at the Netflix documentary Dope Sick or Painkiller, you know, which I think is on Hulu. But if you think that's not happening across the board with all pharmaceutical products, it makes no sense. It's happening everywhere, and they have and they're destroying the health of our country. So I'm going to, you know, immediately identify the toxic exposures that are causing these epidemics, and then I'm going to eliminate them.
I think there's general agreement, even within CDC, that this agency failed, basically got an F at handling the COVID pandemic at a time when we had provided billions of tax dollars for them to prepare for a pandemic like that. And yet, from what I can tell, they're on track to receive a $2 billion increase in their budget this coming year. There's been no reform. There has been no mea culpa. What are your thoughts about CDC?
I mean, my thoughts are that the pharmaceutical industry controls our government. They control the White House, they control the Congress, and they control the regulatory agencies. So I don't anticipate, until we get a president who understands that dynamic and who is determined to dismantle it and unravel it, I don't think there is a solution.
Another thing you speak to frequently is the war, or what you call the pro-war mentality, by many in the Democrat Party and the Republican Party, I think you would say. What are your answers or thoughts as to what you would do about the situation with Ukraine and all of the money that's going out the door now?
Well, with Ukraine, I will settle the war very, very quickly as soon as I get into office. The Russians have tried to settle it twice on terms that were very, very beneficial to us. And in both cases, the United States government blew up those agreements. And
why do you think that is?
I think that the U.S. Wanted the war. They wanted to. And you don't have to, people don't have to listen to me. They were very frank about it. I mean, Lloyd Austin in March of 2022, who's the Secretary of Defense under President Biden, when he was asked, why do we want a war in Ukraine? He said, because it gives us a chance to exhaust the Russian army and degrade its capacity to fight anywhere else in the world. And last week, in the Republican debate, Tim Scott said the same thing. Mitch McConnell has repeatedly said that. So you have Republicans and Democrats on both sides who are saying, you know, the real objective of this war is to degrade the Russian army for strategic reasons. And Ukraine has ended up as a pawn in a proxy war between the United States and Russia. I think it's a bad policy. I don't think our objective should be to degrade the Russian capacity. I don't think Russians threaten the United States. They didn't. Russia had a defensive capacity, but they've never done anything to develop an offensive, imperialistic capacity. But, I mean, most importantly, the Russians made very, very clear efforts to settle the war. The Minsk Accords were fair. We should have encouraged everybody to sign them, and we wouldn't have had this war. In 2019, President Zelensky, or Vladimir Zelensky, before he was president, ran as president. And, you know, at that time, he was a comedian and an actor. He had no political experience, but he won. The presidency in Ukraine was 70% of the vote because he promised to sign the Minsk Accords and have peace with Russia. And what the Minsk Accords would have done was they would have ended the bloodshed in Ukraine at that point. There was a civil war going on where the Kiev government was essentially butchering ethnic Russians in Donbass and Lugansk. And that had been going on since 2014 when we, abetted the overthrow of the democratically elected government of Ukraine and installed our own government. And that government, the moment it was installed, declared, illegalized the Russian language and essentially made the Russian minority in eastern Ukraine into a sort of a despised minority. And when the Russians started, Russians started protesting, they started killing them. They illegalized the Russian language, etc. The Minsk Accords would have left Ukraine and Donbass and Lugansk as part of Ukraine. And they would have signed an agreement to keep NATO out of Ukraine, which is what the Russians have always wanted. They've always said that's a red line. And yet, Zelensky won, after winning on that platform, suddenly pivoted. Nobody has explained why, but clearly it was because he was being threatened by ultra-naturalists within his own government and by the United States, which said, which wanted the war. And then in March of 2022, after the Russians invaded, and he tried to settle, the United States wouldn't help him settle the war, so he had to go to Israel and Turkey, and they hammered out another agreement, which Zelensky initialed. And it was basically Minsk Accords II to withdraw the troop, and the Russians signed it, and Putin began withdrawing troops from Ukraine. And what happened? President Biden sent Boris Johnson over to Ukraine to force Zelensky to tear up that agreement. And since then, we've killed 400,000 Ukrainian kids. And it was morally wrong. It was strategically wrong. We pushed Russia into the arms of China, which is a foreign policy outcome that is terrible for our country. We've given the rise of BRICS, which is now threatening the primacy of the U.S. dollar. Nobody wanted to make BRICS. Now 11 nations have joined it. They control 90% of the oil in the world. We erected a, you know, this threat to the U.S. economy. And we did it because by having a militarized foreign policy rather than a foreign policy that projects economic power abroad rather than military power.
Is there a conflict of interest with questioned dealings by the Biden family in Ukraine that were very lucrative for some members of the family, and now the Biden administration taking the lead and funneling so much money, seems like unlimited money in a way, toward Ukraine?
Yeah, I could not answer that question. I know that Hunter Biden was a part or the hedge fund or the investment firm that he started was I think the majority owner of Metabiota, which is the company that was operating the bioweapons laboratories in the Ukraine. But in terms of his and the president's ownership of other assets in the Ukraine or their participation in other deals, I just don't know enough about it.
What is the status of Secret Service protection for you?
We've made multiple applications for Secret Service protection, and the Biden administration has denied me. I'm the first presidential candidate in history to request Secret Service protection and be denied. It's been pro forma. You know, they have to give you Secret Service protection 100 to 120 days out. They passed that law after my father's death. But they've been, as a matter of course, they've provided to multiple candidates much, much farther out. You know, President Obama had it, I think, over 500 days out. My uncle Ted Kennedy was given it before he even declared. And he was running against a president of his own party.
What reason are they giving you?
They don't really give a reason. They just say that they don't. The White House has determined that it's unnecessary. So it's a very vague reason. The Secret Service itself has been very, very good and very cooperative and has been working with us. And, you know, in our contacts with the Secret Service, they were very confident that I would get Secret Service protection. They have, I think, 8 teams that are ready to go. And I think everybody was shocked when the administration, we gave a 68-page report on the threats, multiple threats to me. You know, I've had home invasions by intruders, by mentally ill people since I declared. I've had, you know, people, so a man got up to the second floor of my house who had tried to invade Kennedy homes before. I've had a gunman come to one of my events and try to get access to me, who had a false ID that identified him as a U.S. Marshal, including badges and multiple badges, lanyard badges and a belt badge that identified him as a federal officer falsely. That had two loaded guns and shoulder holsters and multiple magazines and another gun and knives in a backpack. And it's hard to imagine that there was any legitimate reason for him coming to my speech that heavily armed. And so, I think the Biden administration has decided to play hardball. And they know that 30% of the money that we raise for my campaign, I have to spend on private security, and I think they would rather me spend it on private security than I don't really know what their thinking is, but that's what I imagine. You know, I would like to see the discussions that they had, but I don't think probably I will. I will.
Former President Trump, when I asked the question, said he knows you, he likes you, and he could see working with you in some capacity. What do you think?
I think that's very nice of President Trump to say that.
Could you see working with President Trump in some capacity?
I don't think that I would. I mean, listen, when President Trump asked me to run his Vaccine Safety Commission, I said I would.
To back up, when he first got elected, the story is he spoke with you about establishing a vaccine.
He asked me to come see him. I went to Trump Tower. This was, I think, in early January of 2017. So he had just been elected, but he was not yet president. And he was putting together his plans for governance. And he asked me to come visit him. And I came down right after Christmas. I came to Trump Tower. And he met with me. I met with him, with Steve Bannon, with Michael Pence, and with Kellyanne Conway and Hope Hill and, the sort of leading people in the administration, in the coming administration. And he asked me to chair a Vaccine Safety Commission to look at the issue of vaccine safety, to look at, whether the science was adequate, whether it was being done correctly, and, to see if we really had a cost-benefit analysis of each one of the vaccines to show that by which people could judge whether they were going to avert more problems than they caused. And I agreed to do that. And that when the administration got started, I was, working with the White House. In fact, I met in multiple meetings with Peter Marks from FDA, with Francis Collins from NIH, with Anthony Fauci from NIAID, and with many other people as part of the putting together this Vaccine Safety Commission. And then Pfizer donated $1 million to President Trump, and he appointed Alex Azar from inside the pharmaceutical industry to run HHS, and he appointed Scott Gottlieb, who was Pfizer's business partner, to run the FDA. And at that point, all communications with us stopped. And, Gottlieb went on to do an $88 billion favor for Pfizer, for his former business partner, and then he left the FDA to join Pfizer's board. So so things didn't work out on that.
Would you start a vaccine safety commission?
I don't know exactly what I would do, whether I need a vaccine safety commission. What I will do is I'll open up the databases and I'll instruct NIH to actually do studies that they should have done a long time ago. I don't think I need a commission. I think I need, we need honest governance. We need good governance. And then let the science speak. Let the science go where it may, but let's do some real science on that. And I might put together a group of top researchers, people like Sandra Greenland from Stanford, and other researchers who to help design studies that are bulletproof, so that the entire public will see them. And then I'll also meet with the journals and make sure that those studies do get published, because right now studies that give bad news for pharmaceutical products usually find no place to publish, and if you do publish them, they get retracted very quickly. Anything that displeases the pharmaceutical, the journals are completely dependent on pharmaceutical advertising and on printing preprint prints, which are very, very lucrative for the pharmaceutical industry.
So back to the question, could you see yourself working in any capacity with Donald Trump?
That's not a job that I would look for. The Vaccine Safety Commission was not a job I was looking for. And, I felt like because I that I might be able to help save lives. And You know, so it's hard to say no. But I'm definitely not, you know, I don't want to be in government. I if I'm not able to run things, I would not want to be in government at all.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Introducing Whipped Seafoam Body Butter by Sirenae Cosmetics. Hi, I'm Star, owner of the Lemonade Mermaid. Enriched with the nourishing powers of cocoa butter, mango butter, and shea butter, our body butter whisks you away to a world of deep hydration. Experience the essence of the sea with every application, as this whipped delight leaves your skin refreshed, replenished, and ready to conquer the day. Visit thelemonademermaid.com and make your skin sing with the magic of the sea.
In this age of a highly controlled media landscape, it's never been more important to fight the heavy hand of censorship and support truly independent journalism. Go to CherylAxson.com and click on the store tab for a great way to do that. There are all kinds of fun and functional products designed specifically for independent and free thinkers like you, featuring slogans like, I tested positive for critical thinking, and I need to find some new conspiracy theories, all my old ones came true. Proceeds support independent journalism causes like the ION Awards for off-narrative, accurate reporting. Go to CherylAckison.com and click the store tab today. Thanks for listening, everybody. I hope you enjoyed today's podcast and that if you did, you'll leave us a great review, subscribe, and share it with your friends. Check out my other podcast, Full Measure After Hours. And now you can support independent journalism causes by visiting CherylAckison.com and clicking on the store tab. There are some thought-provoking and fun products designed exclusively for independent and free thinkers like you, such as products with the slogan, I need to find some new conspiracy theories. All my old ones came true. Proceeds benefit independent reporting causes. Do your own research, make up your own mind, think for yourself.